give me liberty or give me death. Yeah, you know who said that. Think a minute. Think. Okay, here it comes. Yep, Patrick Henry. Well, congratulations if you knew that. But let me ask you this. Do you know anything else at all about him? Think for a moment. Anything at all? Well, I happen to know just a little bit. I happen to know that he was the governor of Virginia. I happen to know that he was not exactly of the same mind about church and state as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were. I happen to know he didn't like the original federal constitution, but I didn't know much else until I went to a place called Red Hill and learned all about him. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject today is Patrick Henry and Red Hill.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
I love going to places I've never been before and talking to people I've never met before. And recently I had both experiences and I had them in spades. It was just fantastic. I went to a place called Red Hill. I didn't know anything about Red Hill except that on the internet I read that it was the final home of Patrick Henry. And since we'd not done a show on Patrick Henry, and since I was becoming increasingly concerned that we hadn't done a show on Patrick Henry, I made a special trip down to Red Hill, and I asked the people there to help me out. I spoke to a lovely lady named Hope and a lovely lady named Myra, and the two of them set me up. I didn't realize before I got there that Hope and Myra had set me up with perhaps the perfect person to talk to about Patrick Henry. His name is Mark Cuvion, and I'll let him tell you, but let me just say this about Mark. He knows more about Patrick Henry than I think Patrick Henry himself knew. In fact, Mark knows so much, and we spoke for so long, that we're going to have at least two episodes devoted to Patrick Henry and Red Hill. Maybe even three. We'll just see how things go. But I think you're going to enjoy every minute of it just as much as I did.
Well, my name is Mark Cuvion. I'm originally from New Orleans. And actually, I came up to Virginia when I was 11 on a family vacation. And we went to Colonial Williamsburg. I saw the movie they have at the Visitor Center. I don't know if you've seen that. And right when I saw Patrick Henry in the movie, I just somehow formed an instant attachment. And when
at the age of 11.
At 11. Everything, I guess I saw in him things that I wanted to be. Someone who stood up for what he believed in. Someone who was courageous. Didn't bow to peer pressure. And so when I got back home to Louisiana, went to the library and started obtaining every book I could find on Patrick Henry. And from that, my interest just grew. And when it came time to look for colleges, I started writing the director at Red Hill. His name was Pat Daly in the 1980s. And he
literally had heard of Red Hill.
Yes, through my
through your research
studying.
And you had decided at the age of, I'm guessing, around 17 or 18 that you wanted to work here?
Yeah, well, yeah, about 15, I guess I was about 15. I started writing the director, and he, you know, we had a pen pal relationship. And I said, you know, I'm interested in going to college to study history, to be, you know, close to Red Hill. And he suggested Longwood College, which is about 45 minutes from here. And he said they had a good history department. So my parents were fine with that. Went to a college at Longwood for history and minor in archaeology. And started volunteering at Red Hill when I was in college. And then during the summers, I was given employment. And then from there, 1990, I graduated. I found a position at Jamestown for a few months. And then Colonial Williamsburg, a job came open there. Mm-hmm. So that's where I've been for the last 22 years at Colonial Williamsburg. But I still have big connections to Red Hill. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees, mm-hmm. and I come by anytime I can to help out.
So now you work at Colonial Williamsburg?
Yes.
And may I ask what you do there?
I'm an interpreter in the buildings. Mm-hmm. I help to reenact the court cases, colonial court cases,
right.
based on 18th century court trials. On occasion, I play a character, William Christian, who was Patrick Emery's brother-in-law, and he was his lieutenant colonel when Patrick Emery was colonel of the 1st Virginia Regiment for about 6 months. A piece of history that most people aren't familiar with. Many people don't think Patrick Emery was involved in the war, mm-hmm. at least fighting. But yes, at one point he was commander-in-chief of the Virginia forces and colonel of the 1st Virginia Regiment.
And you portray his...
Lieutenant Colonel, his second lieutenant. In command and brother-in-law, Colonel William Christian.
This is so cool. So. I bet I know somebody you know. You know Cash Earhart, don't
I
you?
I do very well, uh-huh. yes.
And if you, yeah, okay. Cash and I met through the We the People competition. And in fact, we will be seeing each other again at the state finals this year, which are held at Williamsburg now. And in fact, I'm going to be out at Williamsburg, so we may run across each other.
Yes, yep.
Again, in the very near future. And as I have shared with Cash, and as I will, I think I've shared on this show before, I too had a very similar trajectory to yours at the age of about 5 or 6, was out at Colonial Williamsburg. And my mother dressed me up that Halloween as what she called a Williamsburg man, which meant she made a tri-corner hat and a fake wig coming out the side. And I was really irritated with people. I went around and they all said, oh, you're George Washington. I said, no, I'm a Williamsburg man. And they kind of looked at me strangely. Yes, it's a wonderful place. I envy you working there. What a great job. And what a neat connection you have to Red Hill. And I understand that Patrick Henry is somebody you've made a great study of.
Yeah, I've been studying him for over 30 years now. I've published 4 books on Patrick Henry. Mm-hmm. The first one was a manuscript that was written by his great-grandson, Edward Fontaine. And that had never been published, so I transcribed that, put some footnotes, and that was the first project mm-hmm. I did. That was about 15 years ago. And then at the State Library, there are poems that were written by Patrick Henry's children. Unfortunately, Patrick Henry ripped all his poems up after they were read. The idea that...
he was a poet.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know he was a poet. I guess that's why, because he ripped his poems up. Wow.
It's that idea of the 18th century, if you're a philosopher or a poet, you can't be a practical statesman. You know, just that thought process. So he did it purely for the enjoyment of his family. And unfortunately, he ripped his up, but many of the poems written by his children and grandchildren survive. Mm-hmm. So I compiled all those together. And that's called Give Me Poetry, that book.
Great title, Mark.
And then about 10 years ago, I wanted to do a book on all the different homes that Patrick Henry lived in. He lived in about 12 different homes. And there wasn't a lot written on what they looked like, the acreage, how many slaves he had on, you know, in each property. So I came up with that concept. It's called Patrick Henry's Virginia. Mm-hmm. It also covers about a dozen sites associated with him, like Williamsburg and St. John's Church and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then just a couple of months ago, the latest of my projects, Patrick Henry, the Demosthenes of His Age. And this book is based on what his contemporaries thought about him as an orator. So it's almost all primary accounts of Patrick Henry's oratory.
And I'm looking at the stacks of the book right now, and it has a bust of Henry on the front of it. Looks very impressive.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Very much indeed. Well, I guess you qualify as a Patrick Henry expert. So if you wouldn't mind, most of us, of course, have heard of the great speech, the Give Me Liberty, Give Me Death speech. And, of course, we know he's a revolutionary. But I think a lot of people's knowledge gets a little bit fuzzy after that point. And so I wonder if you could just give us the quick 5-minute overview of Henry's life and some of the high points of it.
And this, I think, with Patrick Henry being known solely as an orator, it's important to remember that behind every great speech of his was a resolution, a bill, an agenda that he was trying to push forward. Mm-hmm. And so with his Liberty or Death speech.
Wait, before that, Mark, if you don't mind, can we start chronologically? Where was he born? Where did he grow up? How did he get to be this great statesman?
Sure, he was born in a place called Studley, which is just a few miles above Richmond. Mm-hmm. And his father had come from Aberdeen, Scotland. Mm-hmm. His mother's family, the Winston family, had been in Virginia since the 1660s. And so Patrick Henry was a native-born Virginian. His Studley was a tobacco plantation, had a number of slaves upon the property as well. And his father, especially around Hanover County, where Studley is located, you have a lot of Scotch merchants. Mm-hmm. And his father was kind of grooming Patrick Henry to be a merchant, a storekeeper. So when he was about 15, he was apprenticed to be a clerk at a storekeeper in the county. And then a year after that, his father provided enough money for Patrick Henry and his older brother, William, to open a store on their own. And unfortunately, either through bad management, the competition from the other larger merchants, within a year after the business opened, it was forced to close. Mm. They were in the red. So while Patrick Henry was trying to see what he was going to do next, he marries his childhood sweetheart, Sarah Shelton. She was 16, he was 18 at the time. And of course, along with the marriage, his father-in-law gave him 300 acres of land, a house, and six slaves. And wow. His father also provided his son with five or six slaves. Mm-hmm. So did Patrick Henry marry this early to now make it on his own, not have to live back with his father? That is, might be a possibility. Mm-hmm. But now he has the acreage, the labor to become a freeman, as it were. And so he tried his hand in growing tobacco.
And when you say freeman, that means landholder.
Yes, okay, yes, right. A small, mm-hmm. small landowner. Right. And unfortunately, the property that was cut off from his father-in-law's home had been
what's the word? Depleted?
Yes, depleted.
Yeah, tobacco, of his, right. Yeah.
Yes, nourishments. Mm-hmm. And so he, Patrick Henry, was actually out in the fields alongside his slaves trying to make a living, but the crop was not producing. So he decides to sell a few slaves and open up another store, mm-hmm. pretty much what he was familiar with. And unfortunately for him, it's during the French and Indian War, so the economy is bad.
That's the 1750s, yes, early 1760s.
Yes, about 1757, 1758 is when he opens up mm-hmm. the store. So once again, within about 6 months, his books are in the red. One of his cousins said that at this point, Patrick Henry goes into the law basically just to be able to put food on his family's table. Mm-hmm. So his father, John Henry, he was a magistrate in Hanover County. So Patrick Henry often heard court cases taking place in Hanover Courthouse. Right across the green from Hanover Courthouse was his father-in-law's tavern, which on occasion he helped out. So he's talking to lawyers, talking to magistrates, and he just became interested in the law. So if you look at the accounts from his contemporaries, including Jefferson, Patrick Henry, anywhere from 1 month to 9 months, he studied law. Most accounts have it at 6 weeks. And so after he...
6 weeks?
Yes.
It takes us 3 years these days to educate a lawyer, or at least to basically educate a lawyer, but he did it in 6 weeks.
Yeah, and I think unlike the other gentlemen like Jefferson and George Wythe, these other lawyers who dabbled in the law as a gentleman's profession, Patrick Henry was doing this to put food on his family's table. Mm-hmm. So he had to get that license. He was determined to get it. And whereas most lawyers would study law under a practicing lawyer for about 3 to 4 years to learn the ropes before they received their license, Patrick Henry just borrowed a few law books from his father. And when he thought he was competent enough, he traveled to Williamsburg to be examined by the lawyers of the high court to see if he...
And he did that in 6 weeks.
He did.
That is very impressive.
So George Wythe, who taught law to Jefferson, He became the first professor of law at William & Mary.
Right.
He was one of the two lawyers who signed Patrick Henry's law license, as well as John Randolph, who was the attorney general for the colony at mm-hmm. that time. So with those two signatures, he was allowed to practice law in the county courts.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're at the very beginning of the first of maybe several episodes about a fellow we've never talked about before on this show, Patrick Henry. And we're speaking with Mark Cuvion, who is an interpreter at Colonial Williamsburg, but who drove out to Patrick Henry's final home, a place called Red Hill, just to speak to me. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll talk some more to Mark Cuvion. Stay tuned.
In 1881, Thomas Carson, a Baltimore banker, sold Montpelier to business partners Louis F. Dietrich and William L. Bradley. These two gentlemen were in the fertilizer business, and they used Montpelier as a country retreat, as well as a model farming operation. Extensive remodeling and redecorating was done during this period. This work was so sweeping that by 1897, an article in Architectural Record notes that the interior of Montpelier has been remodeled out of all semblance to its original self. Wallpapers in the aesthetic Anglo-Japanese style were added in many rooms. Fragments of this wallpaper were discovered during subsequent restoration work. In 1900, Dietrich and Bradley sold Montpelier to Charles King Linig. But Linig was not the real owner. He was the agent of William DuPont, of the famous American industrial family. The DuPonts would own and preserve Montpelier throughout most of the 20th century. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Mark Cuvion, who's written several books about Patrick Henry. And before the break, Mark was telling me all about Patrick Henry's early life, and I think we'd gotten just about to the point where Patrick Henry had become a member of the Virginia Bar.
Well, to make a decent living as a lawyer, you had to be licensed in many different counties. So Patrick Henry spent most of the year just going from one courthouse to the next, because back then your fees were set by the legislature at a fixed price, 15 shillings a case. So it didn't matter how sensational it was, how long it took, at the end you got the same amount.
Oh, so you just wanted to sign up as many cases as
yes,
you can.
Yes, the and sheer bulk.
And quite frankly, you want as many quick, simple cases as you can
that
get.
That would help.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Oh, okay, now I'm understanding.
So, yes. Yeah, so
that was called riding circuit,
yes.
Right? Okay, so he and other lawyers, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of riding circuit is very similar in a lot of parts of the country. All the lawyers and the judges ride from town to town, and they just set up in the local tavern or the local saloon or wherever they can hold court, and literally clients are waiting there to hire lawyers, and you meet with your client in the morning, and then you go try your case that afternoon. Is that pretty much what he was doing?
Yes, he was licensed in about seven different counties: Hanover, Goochland, Louisa, Augusta, some more the middle Piedmont and western part of Virginia. At that time, though, magistrates did not travel the circuit yet.
Oh, they didn't?
That comes with the district courts in the 1780s. Mm-hmm. So every county, like Hanover, had a set of judges appointed by the governor. And fortunately for Patrick Henry, a number of the judges were relations to him. His father, John Henry, was the chief magistrate. Anthony Winston, his uncle, was also on the bench. Samuel Meredith, who would become his brother-in-law, also on the bench. John Sim, who was his stepbrother, also a justice of the peace, magistrate for Hanover County. So that that probably helped on occasion.
It sounds like Patrick Henry, though he might not have been a rich man, was very well connected and fairly well off, and was launched pretty well by his family connections.
Yeah, and that's the thing. William Wirt, the first biographer, he was the one to create this image that Patrick Henry basically came from nothing, poor, destitute, And through his share abilities, he rose to a higher office. And a lot of that dealing with his abilities and talents is true. But the Henry Winston family, again, his mother's family, the Winstons, the Henrys, they held a lot of county positions, be it magistrates. His father was also a colonel of the county militia. Mm-hmm. A number of the Winstons were sheriffs and so forth. So he's coming from what we would call the kind of like back county gentry or local gentry mm-hmm. of the time. So he did have the education. It wasn't as extensive as like Jefferson. Patrick Henry attended a local school until he was about roughly about 11. And then his father, who was educated at King's College in Aberdeen, he received a Latin scholarship. He taught Patrick a little bit of Latin and Greek, mathematics, ancient and modern history. So yes, I mean, on the whole, he had a better basic education than at least George Washington did. So that.
So in an era when most people were eking out a living as farmers or maybe local tradesmen, he was certainly not a plantation owner like a Jefferson or a Madison,
yeah.
But he was sort of a middle-class guy.
Yes, okay. Middling class. And Sarah Shelton, who he married, again, the Shelton family, very sturdy farming family in Hanover. Again, he would purchase Hanover Tavern, John Shelton. So, yes, he wasn't coming from the lower ranks.
Okay. So he starts out. He starts practicing law. What happens next?
Well, he's doing pretty good. He's handling, you know, mainly civil disputes, drawing up wills and contracts. And in 1763, that's when you have the famous Parsons cause that he gets involved in.
Okay. And what was that about?
What happens, the background on that is, at this time period, the Anglican ministers, of course, the Church of England is established in Virginia, and each parish minister receives 16,000 pounds of tobacco for their salary each year. And in 1755 and 1757, Virginia suffered a massive drought. So the Virginia legislature, the House of Burgesses, passes a bill stating that you can pay your taxes in current money instead of tobacco money. And they set it at 2 pennies per pound. So tobacco at that period, because of the drought, was going for about 6 pennies a pound. Mm-hmm. Now it's being set at 2 pennies by the House of Burgesses.
Well, see, so the Parsons pound. Are not happy about this.
Yeah, they thought they were going to get a windfall of money. And now the legislature is saying, no, we're going to set it at 2 pennies to help the people.
And this was a period, again, please, you correct me if I'm wrong, but this was a period when the Anglican Church was the official state church of the colony of Virginia. And so these were Anglican ministers who were getting paid by the colony, and this was an assessment. I mean, so this was very much the government
yes.
paying these people, and so now they're not happy with what they're getting paid. Is that what's happening?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And so you had a number of ministers that used their influence in England, members of parliament that they were friends with, the Bishop of London, and they were able to persuade these people to have the king and parliament overturn that 2 penny act that was passed by the House of Burgesses. So now you have a division, you have people siding with the Parsons, which weren't many, and you had the members of the House of Burgesses, most like Patrick Henry, who were Anglican, but they don't like the idea that these ministers have meddled in their ability to pass emergency laws for the colony and having that law overturned by the king. So once the law was overturned, that allowed ministers to go to their county courts to sue for back pay. So Reverend Maury, he sues in Hanover County. He sues the sheriff for back pay. The sheriff collected the parish taxes. And Patrick Henry was hired by the vestry to try to make sure Reverend Maury got as little as possible.
Okay, the vestry is the body of the church.
Yes.
Okay, so it's like the congregation is hiring Patrick Henry to prevent the priest, the Anglican minister,
to getting more money.
Okay. Yeah. This is really interesting because, as I'm sure we'll discuss later, Henry later was seen as a champion of the mm-hmm. Anglican Church and of official state church in Virginia, and of assessments to pay for these ministers. But his first contact with them, he's actually fighting against the ministers on behalf of a local congregation.
Yes, and on behalf of the theory that the Virginia legislature should have the authority to make emergency laws as they saw fit, and that a just law should not be interfered with by the king. So this is starting to lay down the foundations of the Stamp Act. And you have a lot of pamphlets being written at this period by, like, Richard Bland attacking the clergy and their stance and vice versa. And a lot of the arguments that they're using, again, will be come up again with the Stamp Act. Does the king and parliament have the authority to meddle in local affairs, especially involving local taxation issues? How far does the king's prerogative extend when it starts to interfere with a law set up to protect the people's interest?
Mm-hmm.
And so during the trial, Patrick Henry, he's going to first attack the king. And he states that the king, by disallowing this just law, forfeited the rights to his subjects' obedience, that he had become a tyrant. And actually, the deputy king's attorney, Mr. Lyons, he shouts treason towards Patrick Henry by stating the king.
I was about to say that. He's still a young lawyer.
Yeah, he's 27 years old.
He's 27 years old. He goes into court, and he starts calling the King of England a tyrant.
Yes.
When he's still a British subject.
Yes, he says, "A king who annuls such good laws degenerates from being the father of his people into a tyrant. He forfeits all rights to his subjects' obedience."
And this is more than 10 years before we're going to declare independence. This is 1763, you said?
Yes.
Wow.
So you can see where his legal education, I mean, this is coming right from John Locke, the theory or treaties, sovereign and subject, the compact. Mm-hmm. So no doubt his legal background helped him in that, in pursuing that course. After he attacks the king, he then turns his attention on the ministers who were present. And the Reverend Patrick Henry, who's his uncle and his namesake, he's also in the courtroom to give, aid and support to the Reverend Maury.
So he's on the other side.
Yes.
So Uncle Pat is...
He's got to listen to Patrick Henry attack not only the king, but the clergy. And Patrick Henry turns to the jury and he says, "Do these ministers, do they uphold the precepts of the gospel of Jesus? Do they feed the hungry? Do they clothe the naked?" And he said, "Oh no, gentlemen, instead of feeding the hungry and clothing the naked, were their power equal to their will, they would snatch the last biscuit from the hearth of their honest parishioner, the last bed, the last milch cow from the widow." And so he just lays into the ministers as being rapacious harpies. That's the phrase he used against them.
Rapacious harpies.
Yes.
Oh, man, he was getting wound up, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, and the ministers couldn't take anymore. They stood up in the courtroom. Most of them were allowed to sit on the bench next to the magistrates because of their positions in the community, and they stormed out of the courtroom, and the Reverend Patrick Henry was overheard stating when he passed by, he said, "You will repent for this, Patrick. You'll repent for this yet," and he storms out of the room.
Oh, man.
So now it's up to the jury to decide how much in back pay Reverend Maury should receive. And he's supposed to have gotten about £240 in current money. The jury, and probably at least a fourth, if not a third of them, were made up of Protestant dissenters. Mm-hmm. You had a number of Presbyterians on the jury. And so
let's just put this in context. Protestant dissenters were people who didn't want to follow the official state church, the Anglican
Church.
Correct. So basically, Patrick Henry had a sympathetic jury.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so they go back to the jury room and deliberate. Less than 5 minutes, they come back with a verdict of one penny for the Reverend Maury. So they had to award him something. So they gave him a one penny in damages. And the crowd is so overjoyed, they pick Patrick Emery up on their shoulders. They carry him outside. He's now looked upon as a defender of the people's rights.
Right.
And so this really starts his career and will...
Too bad that he was going to get hung by the king and then sent straight to hell.
That is true, too, because after the trial, a number of people wanted to collect accounts from witnesses to make a case of treason against him. But for whatever reason, maybe the pressure put upon him by the bench, it was never pursued. But yeah, so that was even something
he was saying stuff in there that could have gotten him in trouble both in this world and the next, at least according to that Anglican minister uncle of his. Well, that is a really cool story. I had heard of the Parsons case, but I did not know all of those details. That's a great story. Okay, so that really launches his legal career, I'm guessing, right?
Yes, and...
And where was that actually held? Where was
that was a Hanover Courthouse, which still stands.
Oh, so you can go back and see where he was.
Yep.
That's cool. All right.
And then within a year, an opening takes place in Louisa County for the House of Burgesses. And Patrick Emery, owning property in Louisa County, at this time period, you did not have to live in the county to represent it. He would eventually move there, but the people of Louisa would elect him to the House of Burgesses. Mm-hmm. And he arrives about May 20th in 1765 to the House of Burgesses. And within 9 days, he is going to stand up and attack the king again with the Stamp Act issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's sure. And then people are much more familiar with that, but... just in general terms, the Stamp Act was a revenue act. It was we had just concluded roughly this time the French and Indian War, mm-hmm. which was sort of a sideshow to what the British and the Europeans called the Seven Years' War between Britain and France. And the general feeling in Britain was that this was done on behalf of the British American colonies, and therefore the British American colonists should be more than happy to pay for it. And so Parliament started enacting a series of taxation and revenue acts to raise money to pay for this war, and the Stamp Act was one of them. So official documents, newspapers, all had to have stamps, and of course you had to pay money for the stamps, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I got that one right.
Yep, and okay. So when Patrick Emery arrives, the Parliament had already passed the Stamp Act. The king had put his royal authority or approval to it, and it reaches Virginia about the same time Patrick Emery arrives in Williamsburg that the king had approved the Stamp Act, that's now law of the land, and that it's to go into effect on November 1st, 1765. It might be something they did to help their cause, but they waited to the very end of the session. Most of the men had gone home. There were supposed to be about 116 members of the House of Burgesses present, and 39 were all that were present when Patrick Emery and George Johnston introduces the Stamp Act resolutions. What happens, George Johnston is going to stand up and ask that the House of Burgesses be turned into a committee of the whole to discuss the passage of the Stamp Act. Patrick Emery then stands up, seconds that motion. The rest of the House agrees, and then he offers his famous resolutions against the Stamp Act, basically stating that we had lost no rights by crossing the Atlantic Ocean, that we should be born or treated as free-born Englishmen, and among these basic rights is the right of self-taxation. And we don't know exactly what happens on May 29th. All seven appear to have passed the Committee of the Whole, and then on May 30th, the House meets again to go one by one and pass them or reject them. And it's the fifth resolution where Patrick Emery states that only the representatives of the people have the right to tax the people and not Parliament. That creates most of the tension in the House. Mm-hmm. You have some of the older men like George Wythe, Peyton Randolph. They're going to stand up and denounce Patrick Emery. Not that they don't agree with him in sentiment, but the Stamp Act had already passed. The time to protest it had already taken place. The House of Burgesses a few months earlier had protested the Stamp Act, but now that it had become law of the land, they believe that you can no longer attack it. And Patrick Henry refused to accept that. He realized if we accepted the Stamp Act, we would lose now and forever our right of self-taxation. Mm-hmm. And so there's a heated debate over the fifth resolution. Patrick Henry stands up and states that he has read in former times that Tarquin and Caesar had each their Brutus, Charles I, his Cromwell, and George III. And when he mentioned George III, the members shouted treason towards him, comparing the King of England to the slain tyrants.
Right. It's like somebody today comparing somebody to Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
First we had Adolf Hitler, and now we've got President so-and-so. That's, yeah, I can see that would be an inflammatory comparison.
Yep, and again, being a good lawyer, he knew how to skirt the edge of treason. He replied by saying, George III, may he profit by their example. So he's basically giving the king a warning. If he doesn't change his ways, he might end up like the tyrants in history.
I'm not calling him a tyrant. I'm saying that if he's not careful, he might become a tyrant.
Yes.
So Patrick Henry, I'm just trying to help the king as one of his loyal subjects.
Exactly.
There we go. That's a very lawyerly perspective.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with a remarkably knowledgeable fellow by the name of Mark Cuvillon, who's telling me all about Patrick Henry. And we're just getting to the point where Patrick Henry is becoming the revolutionary fellow that we all remember from great school. After the break, we'll talk some more with Mark, and then we'll also have a little visitor from Montpelier, so stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's continue our conversation with Mark Cuvillon, who knows more about Patrick Henry than anybody else I've ever met.
So yes, I mean, within a two-year, well, even a one-year period, in 1763, December, he declares King George II to be a tyrant, and then a few months later, declaring George III to be a tyrant for allowing the Stamp Act to pass and not being, again, a protector of the rights of his people. And the resolution passed by one vote. Patrick Henry leaves later that evening to go back home, and the other members who remained, they found a precedent in the books to have a resolution expunged. So they removed the fifth resolution the day after it was passed. The good thing is, all seven resolutions that were passed by the Committee of the Whole the first day on May 29th, they found their way to the newspapers throughout North America. So now most of the colonists believe all seven inflammatory resolutions were passed by the House of Burgesses, when in reality, it was only four out of the seven that actually made the cut.
So now he's a national figure.
Yep. John Adams, when Patrick Henry goes to Philadelphia to attend the First Continental Congress, he was already known.
And that wasn't until 1774. Okay, so this is almost 10 years, with 1765, right?
Yes.
When he's doing this. So 9 years ahead of the First Continental Congress, Patrick Henry is a guy who's, you know, is skating on the edge of treason and one of the first to say, essentially, no taxation without representation.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of people debate, you know, who started the revolution, or at least the ball rolling towards independence. Some point to James Otis and others. And again, what makes Patrick Henry's role so important is, you know, the Stamp Act had passed. Franklin said it's a bitter pill we must swallow. James Otis said...
Yeah, Franklin was in his conciliatory period. In fact, he was over in England at this time.
Yep.
And he was still trying to sort of mediate between the colonies and,
exactly,
and Britain. Okay. So not everybody was revolutionary at this point.
No, and again, most people thought it was a time and place to attack it. And what makes Henry so important is he attacks it after it was the law of the land. And had he not done that, that would have firmly placed parliamentary taxation upon the colonies. Jefferson, who was a spectator at the Capitol building when Patrick Henry attacked the Stamp Act. He would later write that it was that speech and those resolutions that started the ball of independence, or the ball rolling towards independence. Hmm. So certainly Jefferson thought that the fuse was lit with those Stamp Act resolves.
I'm guessing Jefferson sat in the back and said nothing.
Well, at that point, he was attending college, mm-hmm. so he had not yet been elected to the legislature.
The house,
yeah. So, yes, he was just a bystander, mm-hmm. yes.
All right, so the 1760s progress. What happens after the Stamp Act?
Let's see, now you start, and of course what happens is every time the House of Burgesses, the people's representatives, attack an act of Parliament, the governor dissolves them, tells them to go home. He dissolves them right after he gets word that the Stamp Act resolves have been passed. Most of the men had already left. And when they attack the Townsend duties in 1769, the governor is going to dissolve them, send them home.
Is this Lord Dunmore?
It's going to be a number of them. But yes, Botetourt and Dunmore, the last two royal governors, mm-hmm. are the ones that are dissolving the legislature.
So basically the Burgesses make a lot of noise. They pass resolutions. It gets printed up. But then almost as soon as they pass them, the governor expunges them or negates them and then dissolves the House of Burgesses.
Yeah, and he's pretty much abusing that power because the governor is only supposed to dissolve them after all the business of the colony is attended to.
Right.
But they're starting to use that as a basically a weapon or a means of punishing the rowdy members of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And so by 1774, they've been dissolved, prorogued a number of times. They're getting tired of it. So they start meeting without the governor's approval. And they start meeting at St. John's Church. That's, of course, where Patrick Henry will give his famous Liberty or Death speech. When the governor is out of Williamsburg,
mm-hmm.
They're going to meet back at the Capitol building.
Wait, St. John's Church is not
in Richmond.
It's in Richmond.
Yes.
That's right. Okay. So that, okay, I just want to be clear on that. So they're not even meeting in Williamsburg, which is the colonial capital. They would meet in Richmond.
Yes, they
up
call
the river.
They call themselves the late representatives of the people. On one occasion, they meet at the Raleigh Tavern. They never give up that right to assemble freely and to petition to government. And so, yes, when the governor is away, they meet in the Capitol building. When he's in town, they'll meet in Richmond at St. John's Church. And it's the second convention, as I mentioned a moment ago, where Patrick Henry will give his Liberty or Death
speech. And what was the date of that speech?
March 23rd, 1775.
So March 23rd, 1775, only about a month before Lexington and Concord.
Yes.
So things are pretty advanced at that point. And what would actually prompted that? Let's put that speech in context. What was the actual issue that was being debated that day?
Yeah, of course, you've had the meeting of the First Continental Congress. You have British soldiers now stationed in Boston, mm-hmm. more arriving. And with Lord Dunmore now dissolving the legislature, the House of Burgesses cannot reinstate laws that are about to expire,
mm-hmm.
and one of those laws is the militia bill. Every 3 years, roughly, it has to be reinstated. And so Virginia in 1775 is technically without a militia because the governor won't call them back into a session. He's afraid what they might come
yeah, I could with. See if I were the governor, I were the British governor, I wouldn't particularly want there to be a militia in Virginia at that time.
So yes, you have all these British troops being sent to the north. You have the militia bill expiring. And so Patrick Henry, he is going to stand up and state that a well-regulated militia is the best means to defend people's rights.
Wow, and that sounds very much like the Second Amendment.
Yes.
And in fact, the quartering of troops, of course, is the Third Amendment, or
yes.
the prohibition of that's in the Third Amendment. So we're getting pretty constitutional here already. All right,
yes.
Go on.
And so, yes, he offers this resolution that Virginia should put itself into an immediate posture of defense,
mm-hmm.
by creating independent militia companies, independent of the governor's control. And so he's hoping every county will have one or more militia independent companies, that they'll be in constant training in case any emergency arises.
In other words, in case the British show up in
yes.
in Virginia.
Yes, and I mean, he doesn't you know, in the speech, he states that, you know, what more proof do you need? Troops are already here in North America. The war, as he says, has actually begun. You know, why stand we here idle, that we must be prepared, even if we don't, you know, want to go to war with England, we must prepare ourselves in case that comes about. And a lot of the members, of course, they're like, well, why don't we just do this in private, you know, kind of, as it were, on the down low, let's not make a resolution. And once again, it's the same members that attacked him during the Stamp Act, Edmund Pendleton, Peyton Randolph, these conservative men opposed Patrick Henry's resolution.
Some of those old fogies like me, they don't want all this revolutionary stuff. And he's still now, by this time, what, getting close to 40?
Yes, he's in 37, I believe, is
so
when
he's still, he's still a mere stripling. He's still a young man. Okay, so he's still got that revolutionary fervor. And what's the actual quote? Now, I've heard it said several different times, but what point does he actually get up and make, and what actually does he say?
Well, yes, and this is the idea that every speech, there is something behind it, as
right.
I mentioned in the beginning. So to support his resolution to arm Virginia, the speech itself is probably about 25, 30 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, he says, gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. Why stand we here idle? And what is it that gentlemen wish, what would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And the interesting...
Well, you have to stop there. I mean, it's been 200 years plus.
Yeah.
And those words just still ring down the centuries, don't they? I mean, that guy had a way with words, and I bet he was standing up in a ringing voice, and it was echoing. I've been to that church, and I know the setting, and I encourage people to do that. So what's the name of the church again, so people can go?
St. John's Church.
And it's still there.
Yep.
Okay, you can go and sit in the pews, you know, basically across from where he was, and I encourage people to do that, because that'll really set it up for you. That was an amazing moment.
And just a side note, back then it was called Henrico Parish Church,
mm-hmm.
St. John's Church. That name is attached to it about the 1820s.
Okay.
So, yes. And it's interesting, Patrick Henry had a ivory letter opener. And in fact, we have it on display here in the
really?
Museum. And when he said, give me liberty, he held it up. And when he said, or give me death, he thrust it to his breast like a dagger.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the men who wrote about what they saw that day, they all mentioned that his actions reminded them of Cato, the martyr, that he would rather die than live under Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
And so this image of, you know, being stabbed, being in chains, was a very classical image that these people would have recognized and did as a comparison to Cato.
Sure. As educated men, many of our founders, if they didn't speak Latin, they could at least read some Latin.
Yes,
they were very familiar with Roman history, and they would make these references frequently. So that was very effective rhetorical technique, especially for that audience.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and I hate to stop there, but that's about all the time we have today for Mark Cuvion and his remarkable recitation of the history, the biography of Patrick Henry. And don't worry, we will get to Red Hill eventually. We've only touched upon it a little bit, but there's much more to come. In the meantime, why don't we change gears slightly and for a few minutes talk about our old buddies at Montpelier. I'd like you to hear from Christian Coates, who's going to tell you about a very important development project at Montpelier.
Well, we're getting ready to refurnish the old library, probably the most important room in the Montpelier Mansion.
Well, what does that involve?
Well, right now it's a great big empty space, so it involves a lot. We'll be bringing in lots and lots of bookcases, as you can imagine, desks, chairs, anything that would make the library, come to life.
And this is what we're talking about here is probably the holiest of holies at Montpelier.
That's right.
This is where Madison sat for months doing his research on the Virginia plan. And currently it's set up as sort of a mini visitor center, you know, with the screens and things in there. And
yeah, actually, we took out the TV about 6 months ago.
Oh, okay. I haven't been in the mansion in the better part of a year. Okay, so what's in there now?
Well, again, right now it's a big empty room. So it's pretty hard to get people to realize what kind of a space it was. By the time Madison died, his library encompassed some 4,000 volumes. So, you know, the space, even though it's a large space, would have been packed to the brim with books and pamphlets and papers.
And are you going to do the same thing?
Yeah, we're going to try. It's going to be hard to bring that quantity of books back in, but we're going to evoke as much of it as we can by populating the room with as many shelves as we can put in there and still get 18 or 20 visitors in there at a time.
Now, here's the historical reconstruction question. Now, most of the mansion is set up and restored to the period of the Madison's retirement, right?
The 1830s,
right?
Yeah, late 20s.
Okay,
yeah.
But of course, the significance of this room was primarily in 1787 when Madison was there. Now, are you going to restore it to 1787 or are you going to restore it to 1830s?
Well, that's a great question. And we struggled with this one quite a bit. We kind of went back and forth about which period to restore it to, because you're right, the most historically important period is when Madison is in there in the 1780s working on his preparations before the Constitutional Convention. But because the rest of the house is restored to the retirement period, the 20s and 30s, we made a conscious decision to not confuse visitors and restore that room to the same period. The room also went through a number of architectural changes in the later additions in 1810. And so architecturally, the room reflects the later period. We're going to refurnish it to the later period. But the story that we're going to tell in there is the story of Madison and his homework, if you will, before the Federal Convention.
I see. Now, in the 1820s and 30s, then, he already had a new library on the ground floor, right?
That's correct.
So what was the relationship between those two rooms in the 1820s and 30s?
So you can imagine the library on the ground floor as being more of a working space. You go to a library today, and you have the reference library, where you see everybody sitting down at desks and working and looking at books. And then, of course, in a big library, you have the stacks, right? Those rooms that are just floor after floor of books packed to the gills. And that's what the old library is going to represent in the retirement era. It's the stacks. It's the warehouse of information that he's amassed over his lifetime.
Okay. So, I mean, now the next question, of course, is once you get the architecture right, once you get the shelves up against the walls or wherever else you're going to put them, you got to get the books. How are you getting the books?
Well, that's an issue, and I'm leaving that to the curators because that's their job. But I think we're going to probably be able to get 1,000 books or so into the space. And I think that'll go a long way to giving the idea of the mass of volumes that were in there. If we can say, look at this, this is 1,000 books. Imagine 4,000 books in here. You get an idea of what that would look like. There's just no way that we're going to be able to fill that room the way it was and still get visitors into the space. So we have to make some concessions.
Yeah, you got to compromise. It's kind of like putting air conditioning in. Seriously, I mean, these are the sorts of things you have to do, or electricity, or a burglar alarm. All of those things were not there then, but they have to be there now.
I can tell you today it's about 15 degrees outside, and I sure appreciated the fact that that house is heated today and not by fireplaces.
I bet you do. Christian Coates of Montpelier, thanks very much for telling us all about it.
Thanks, Stuart. Been a pleasure being here.
And that's our show. What a fascinating tale we're telling, isn't it? And I'm just so excited that we've got much more to tell you all about Patrick Henry and Red Hill. But in the meantime, I would like to go ahead and thank Myra Trent and Hope Marston, who work at Red Hill and who arranged for this remarkable interview with Mark Cuvillon. I'd also like to thank Hope's mom, because I met Hope's mom when I was there, and the three of those ladies, Hope, Hope's mom, and Myra, just made my visit a very hospitable and very pleasant time. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. Oh, and the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps do our wonderful theme song. And as you listen to it, remember that you are a part of the American experiment.